Invisibility in everything is the thing we aim at in modern war. Solomon J. Solomon, 1916.
One August evening, almost exactly 88 years ago, an eminent portrait painter called Solomon J. Solomon joined his colleagues for a meeting at the Royal Academy in the heart of London. The routine event was dramatically interrupted, as Solomon recorded in his diary.
That day, France had declared war on Germany. Everyone remembers the feeling of anxiety in England as to whether the politicians would leave France to bear alone the brunt of a German invasion. I can recall that tense feeling at a meeting of the Royal Academy Council, held in a beautiful suite of rooms at Old Burlington House. A dozen silver candelabra with their lighted candles lend a note of serious dignity to the room. Towards the end of our meeting, an eerie, distant shouting is heard from a howling mass of presumably young people swaying up St. James's Street. It has been announced from Buckingham Palace that we were also to take up arms against Germany.
So, what could a middle-aged artist do for his country at such a time? Nothing in Solomon J. Solomon's career so far prepared him for an active military role. He came from a prosperous Jewish family, and the well-born subjects of his portraits were far removed from the howling mob he heard that evening swaying up St. James's Street.
Solomon had painted everybody from the top, and I mean quite literally the top down.
Peter Gross of the Ben-Uri Gallery. He's writing a study of Solomon.
In 1914, he took over the commission to paint the coronation lunch. He painted members of the English aristocracy. He painted leading politicians like Ramsay MacDonald and Lord Asquith. And also, he was, among other things, the painter of choice for what might be described as the Anglo-Jewish aristocracy of the time.
Almost immediately, Solomon threw himself into war work of a kind that seems at first to have nothing in common with the upper crust portrait. He started to create camouflage. The importance of deceiving your enemy's eyes had long been recognised in warfare. Think of the Trojan horse or of the soldiers in Macbeth who covered themselves in foliage so that they resembled a wood advancing on Dunsinane. The British army had itself started exchanging redcoats for khaki in the 1840s, but Solomon realised that modern warfare, particularly with the advent of aerial reconnaissance, demanded a new and more strategic approach to camouflage. The largely unknown diary in which he recorded his wartime experiences offers a fascinating account of his search for new forms of concealment that would be effective on the entrenched battlefields of the Western Front. It also reveals that he often worked in the face of opposition and ridicule, even from his own family.
In August 1914, my family and I were spending the summer months in a house in St. Albans, and I was scouring that town for all the muslin dyes and bamboo canes I could afford. Amid the laughter of the rest of the house party, I littered the lawns and hung on the tennis net all the canvas that I had dyed. I had read accounts of German airmen dropping bombs on our trenches, so I experimented with screens to cover the trenches. I sent some screens to the War Office, and they invited me to Woolwich Dockyard. 50 yards of trenches had been dug there, and a large number of officers, including generals, were present. A few men helped me fix a screen over one trench. Then an airman flew overhead to test the effect. He saw the uncovered trenches, but could not spot the one I had screened. The officers were enthusiastic. Drawings of the things were sent to France, but the commander-in-chief turned down the idea. No wonder. He was then retreating from the Germans.
So, what is a man like Solomon J. Solomon, considerably into his 50s by the time the First World War breaks out, what is he doing engaging in the war?
Solomon J. Solomon regarded himself as an Englishman, an English Jew, and he was part of that inner circle of English Jewry at the time, the so-called cousinhood. Anglo-Jewry, as a group, volunteered. That's what they did. They went to war. And I think Solomon J. Solomon felt that this was something that it was incumbent upon him to do. At the age of 55, he clearly wasn't going to be a great deal of use as a frontline soldier, but he was a painter, he knew how to paint. This is what he did. He did it 6 days a week as a painter, and he felt probably that he should do it 6 days a week as a soldier.
Peter Gross. Solomon J. Solomon soon found himself a lieutenant colonel, working in France on a project he would never have anticipated in peacetime. He was improvising an observation post that looked like a willow tree, but had a slender steel trunk that could bear the weight of a hiding soldier. It was a job that brought unexpected problems.
The first of the trees constructed by the camouflage unit was put up last night, and is a really excellent reproduction, which can hardly be discovered at a distance of even a few yards. It will, I am sure, prove of the greatest assistance. Future trees, however, must be made bigger inside, as some of the observing officers who wish to use the tree cannot get up it. I have already, in my fresh designs, given 3 extra inches to their diameter. But even these would not be too comfortable for stout men clothed in winter uniform to ascend. To increase them much more, as the French were doing, would be to give them away. What strikes one as characteristic of the French landscape is the slenderness and newness of the trees, so different from the century-old elms which surround our fields.
Solomon soon discovered that he was not the only camoufleur at work on the Western Front. He made contact with the French, who had set up a considerable camouflage workshop, headed by the painter Giron de Scavola. As Solomon notes, de Scavola was a bit of a dandy. He worked in a converted barn, but his habit of wearing white kid gloves impressed the British High Command, even though they might have seemed more appropriate in a Paris salon. The French led the way in Europe, but in America, modern camouflage is claimed as the invention of one of their artists.
The idea of camouflage itself came from Abbot Thayer. He is the father of camouflage.
Richard Murray of the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, D.C., putting the case for Abbot Thayer. Like Solomon J. Solomon and Giron de Scavola, Abbot Thayer had painted his share of society portraits, but he also had a great regard for nature. In the first decade of the 20th century, he lived with his family in a rural artist's colony in New Hampshire, sleeping outdoors, keeping wild animals as pets, and revering the woods around them as God's studio. It was this devoted attention to nature that brought Thayer to the question of camouflage.
He was born in Boston in 1849. He grew up in New England and was familiar with the fields and streams and mountains of New Hampshire. So he would study the animals in the forests and streams and such, and became really quite good at painting fish and critters of various kinds.
Thayer's observations led him to note that birds often have bright patches of colour which tend to break up their outline. In his book Concealing Coloration in the Animal Kingdom, published in 1909, Thayer also claimed that an important principle of animal coloration was what he called countershading.
Countershading on birds and animals would place the darkest coloration on the top of the, or the back of the bird or animal, to counter the bright sunlight falling upon it. Then the bottom of the animal was the lightest because it was seen against a dark forest floor. What happens is that the bottom and top tend to counteract any notion of a continuity of shape. So he says then that as you are looking at the animal in the bush, you see through it. You cannot see it. You see it as it fades into its background. Mm. Now, of course, one of the most difficult parts of his theory was proving it to scientists. And one little hitch on this was that in order to see the concealing coloration or the camouflage of the animal, one had to see it from the point of view of its predator. So for distinguished Smithsonian scientists to get down on their knees in the mud of the mall and look at animals the way a predator would see them was a little difficult, and he ran into a lot of ridicule for it, and particularly from Teddy Roosevelt, who himself was an amateur naturalist, and called Thayer's ideas bunk. His cousin, however, Franklin Roosevelt, recognized the usefulness of this idea and got Thayer to do some camouflage for ships. He was able to transfer the notion of animal coloration to the notion of, or to the designs of camouflage relatively easily. It was getting people to believe it that was his hard part.
Thayer was a highly strung man, But even without that personal difficulty, the military was hardly predisposed to accept the apparently weird recommendations of artists. Solomon J. Solomon's diary is full of awkward moments when top brass and camouflage artists confront each other in mutual disbelief.
France, 1916. Who says a painter can't organise? This seemed to be a military prejudice. When an artist is composing an imaginative picture, his organising faculties are at full stretch. We return to Saint-Omer. Later, we set off to meet General Ivor Phillips to discuss observation posts. On our way, fearing we might be late for lunch, we stopped at Lier, where I bought a camembert cheese, a long loaf and some fruit. What the dandified staff officers would have thought of a lieutenant colonel carrying these foodstuffs to the car, I can imagine. But I have enough of the bohemian in me, in spite of a uniform, to enjoy such foraging.
As a well-established opponent of avant-garde experimentation, Solomon was hardly considered a bohemian in London. Yet an officer who was prepared to carry his own camembert and baguette was apparently an oddball in the army. Perhaps some of these suspicions are understandable. Professor Roy Behrens is an artist and historian who has studied the development of camouflage.
During World War I, there were so many artists who had volunteered or requested to be assigned to camouflage. And there may have been some jealousies because lots of people in the infantry regarded those jobs as rather cushy, soft jobs. But artists are notoriously, or, you know, whether it's right or wrong, they're notoriously associated with a kind of bohemian way of behaving. And the military is associated with the exact opposite, with regimentation and discipline and strictness. I think another problem is that the army likes neatness, highly polished surfaces and everything in order and straight and all that sort of thing, and haircuts. And camouflage itself depends very much on breaking symmetries and on sort of messing things up.
The British High Command certainly encountered bohemian ideas when Abbot Thayer came to London during the First World War to present a scheme for camouflaging snipers. Thayer met up with his friend, the British-based American painter John Singer Sargent. The plan was that the two of them would go to meet the British military together.
Sargent was to introduce Thayer to the High Command in London. The presentation was by Sargent because Thayer became so nervous he ran away. Didn't even meet the generals. So he had a box, a kind of a valise, I suppose, that he brought with him. So here is Sargent, and he's got this valise in front of these generals with their beautifully tailored uniforms and starched shirts and
the red tabs,
the whole thing. And Sergeant opens the valise, and here is an old hunting jacket that Thayer had rigged up and painted with splotches of color and had pinned pieces or long strips of cloth of different colors across the front and back in diagonal shapes. This, of course, being his principle of breaking up the outline of the infantryman. And they looked at this, and Sargent said, "I was so embarrassed, I wouldn't touch this thing with my stick." they sort of laughed at this crazy artist who was trying to convince them of the usefulness of a jacket that's all daubed up with paint. But Thayer left London totally depressed, ran back to New York, where he nearly had a nervous breakdown. And finally, about a month later, a letter from Sargent reached Thayer, and it said, "Where are you? The High Command has given us a squad of soldiers to test your theory." And guess what? The sharpshooters for the British infantry dressed in Thayer's design.
Richard Murray. Meanwhile, Solomon J. Solomon had been asked to turn his attention to the distinctive problem of camouflaging Britain's newly invented tanks. This work took him to Suffolk, where the new weapons were being tried out in a secretive compound known as the Elvedon Explosives Area.
12th of May, 1916. Wake up at 3 a.m. and make drawings for the men to work from. Painted with my own hand for the greater part, 3 tanks in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. I had to take off my tunic and put on overalls, just like an ordinary house painter. Quarters were found for us at Lord Ivy's stables and rooms above, which did very well. Someone had induced the head butler of the Senior Army and Navy Club to cater for us. He was renowned for his cocktails, and the younger bloods did full justice to his concoctions. The staff secretary was a good deal of a dandy. With him and others of his kidney, I lost prestige because I painted with my own hand instead of ordering the people about, and also perhaps because I was forced to ride a pushbike. On one occasion, I said that the last time I was in this part of the country I was painting portraits. "What?" said the secretary with a sneer. "You were painting portraits of the Cadogans and now you are painting tanks?"
One might detect a whiff of anti-Semitism in some of the ridicule that Solomon faced as he applied his so-called pink sunsets to the first tanks that would ever see action. Solomon himself makes no such suggestion, however. As Peter Gross speculates, Solomon's interest in camouflage, concealment, and blending may reflect his experiences as a Jew concerned to fit into English society.
Insofar as Solomon spent a part of his time painting the leading figures of the Anglo-Jewish world in terms that would present them as Englishmen, albeit Jewish Englishmen or Anglo-Jews, there is a sense of concealment is perhaps a strong word, but there is a sense of perhaps camouflage that might have, at a very deep level, have influenced some of his thinking or some of his approach to the problems of camouflage. He, I'm sure, would have dismissed it as whatever the Edwardian equivalent of psychobabble is, but nevertheless, it may be an underlying factor in his work.
So it's a question of how you fit a figure into a background. I mean, this would have been an issue for him in more senses than just how you make an observation post look like a tree.
Absolutely. How people fitted into society was certainly a problem that he wrestled with both on a purely intellectual level and also as a painter.
Concealment could be vital, but not all camouflage in the First World War was concerned with making buildings, guns and machines disappear into their background. At sea, a merchant ship painted black provided an easy target for a submarine's torpedoes. In 1917, the painter Norman Wilkinson dreamed up an innovative solution to this problem.
On my way back to Devonport in the early morning, in an extremely cold train, I suddenly got the idea that since it was impossible to paint a ship so that she could not be seen by a submarine, the extreme opposite was the answer. In other words, to paint her, not for low visibility, but in such a way as to break up her form, and thus confuse a submarine officer as to the course on which she was heading.
Wilkinson was a fairly conventional marine painter who at the time was serving on patrol ships in the English Channel. Known as dazzle camouflage, his solution involved painting bold shapes and stripes all over a ship. It was adopted very quickly, and soon many of Britain's merchant vessels looked like weird avant-garde visions.
The intention was to confuse the U-boat torpedo gunner, because that was the threat it was addressed to. And so the whole notion was if I could throw off the aim of the torpedo gunner, and how can I do that? Well, I can confuse him as to the course of the ship. Not the direction that it will be in now, but the place it will be by the time the torpedo arrives, because the torpedo gunner had to lead the target. It took a while for the torpedo to get to the ship, and so he had to anticipate where the ship was going with considerable accuracy and then fire it.
Lines by G.F. Norton. Captain Schmidt at the periscope, you need not fall and faint, for it's not the vision of drug or dope, but only the dazzle paint. And you're done, my pretty hun, you're done in the big blue eye, by painter men with a sense of fun, and their work has just gone by. Cheerio, a convoy safely by.
Wilkinson's dazzle painting reminded many of the modern art of the time, the work, say, of Picasso and the Cubists. Roy Behrens.
There's that story that about Gertrude Stein and Pablo Picasso walking down the streets in Paris shortly after the war began, and And suddenly they see these camouflaged cannons and whatever coming back from the front. And they've been painted in all of these crazy patterns. And Picasso is spellbound, and he stops and he points to this stuff and he says, you know, we invented this. This is Cubism. But more recently, it's been discovered that he sent letters to the front advising some of his friends who were in the infantry on how to camouflage. He was very interested in the Harlequin patterns on the Harlequin leotards, and he thought that if you applied that kind of confusing dazzle shape on any surface, maybe even the uniform of an army officer, that they would become confusing to see in the field.
Sadly for Picasso, no officers ever marched into battle dressed like Harlequins. Yet, by the time the Second World War broke out in 1939, many once bizarre ideas about camouflage had been accepted by the military. In Britain, one of the leading camoufleurs of the Second World War was, coincidentally, a friend of Picasso's. The British surrealist Roland Penrose wrote the Home Guard Manual of Camouflage in 1941. It's full of practical tips.
Use of paints and colours. Green is the colour which is likely to present most difficulty. It is very easy to err on the side of mixing a green with too much blue. The majority of green paints suffer from this drawback when used in camouflage. There is very little blue-green in nature. Hence, it is very important that light green should be kept yellowish in appearance and dark green should have a good proportion of brown.
I don't think he actually invented anything startling, but what he did was he was a very good disseminator.
Roland Penrose's son, Anthony, remembering his father's wartime role. We talked in Roland Penrose's study, which is still preserved in the Sussex farmhouse he shared with his wife, the American photographer Lee Miller.
He was known to be a very good lecturer. One of his tricks in his lecture was that he got David Sherman, the life photographer, to photograph Lee Miller, who he was then living with in London. Sherman photographed Lee Miller wearing nothing except camouflage paint and a camouflage net with a few very strategically placed little pieces of straw. And you can imagine that this made his lecturers extremely popular and his audience very attentive. What particularly caught my mind was the kind of camouflage suits that he wrote about in the little book that he prepared, the Home Guard Manual of Camouflage. And there's some wonderful pictures of suits made out of old sacks and things like that, which are very cunning because the whole idea was improvisation. There wasn't any money to spend on making clever uniforms. It all had to be done from things they could find. In those days, every farm had lots of sacks on it, and that was readily available. And the ingenuity and also the kind of, almost dare I say it, the humour with which he created these camouflage suits was really something I find very beguiling. As a kid, my chums and I used to take sacks from the barn here on the farm and try and make the camouflage suits. And of course, we were entirely confident that when we wore them in the woods that nobody could see us at all.
Cover. For the Home Guard, who must frequently fall back on improvisation to solve their problems, rubbish of all sorts is one of the most useful and obtainable materials. In towns, scrap, slag heaps and rubble can often be used in this way, whereas in the country, old carts, agricultural instruments, logs and even manure heaps, provided they are only for temporary use, make excellent cover.
Some practical hints from Roland Penrose's Home Guard Manual of Camouflage. As for Solomon J. Solomon, he spent the last months of the First World War attempting to persuade the British generals that the Germans were using camouflage extensively to cover roads and even airfields. But his argument, based on evidence from aerial photographs, was almost entirely ignored. His diary records snub after snub.
From the moment I saw through the German covering of large areas for the concealment of troops and activities, I was smiled at as a troublesome lunatic by the chiefs of the Air Force and by every army administration to which I took my well-authenticated information. At the Royal Academy banquet in 1920, a war banquet, since all the army men of note were present, the president referred to the part artists played in the war and mentioned my name. A general officer then turned to a brother academician and said, "A dangerous man." I smiled at this when told, but I saw its significance.
Yet Solomon was right all along. After the war, he returned to the battlefields to find evidence of German camouflage in exactly the places he had suggested it to be. He recorded his findings in his book, Strategic Camouflage, the first account of its kind. And what of the present? There may be little place for the artist in today's digitized high-tech warfare, where the requirement is to outwit not the naked human eye, but all kinds of electronic heat or infrared sensors. Yet the old art of camouflage does live on here and there. The Canadian Air Force's Hornet jet has a false cockpit canopy painted on its underside in the hope that an enemy pilot would find it difficult to judge which way up the thing is flying. Solomon J. Solomon would have been intrigued by that illusion, I think. Perhaps he would have felt vindicated too. At the end of his book, Strategic Camouflage, he signed off with a well-aimed rhetorical flourish, a riposte to every military sneer and snub.
There need be no mistrust of the devotion or the all-round capacity of the artist in these matters. The most advanced and enlightened people of their age in Europe, the Italians of the Renaissance, knew how to value the artist's faculty for visualization and entrusted the designing of the fortification of their towns and their arms to the painters and sculptors among them. To walk in the footsteps of Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo and Cellini in time of war makes their humble followers feel proud. They need no other reward. Invisibility in everything is the thing we aim at in modern war. Solomon J. Solomon, 1916.